Walking beside Ronald Asher, coming down the hallway from the quiet room, I flashed a bad scene I'd been part of 5 days earlier at the Citizen Reporter offices. A copy cub, an arrogant 19-year-old black, had come up to my desk and sat down all over my paperwork that afternoon. The young writer's name was John Seawright, and he was in the habit of riding me about verisimilitude in my Horn articles. I was just about to tell him to get off the desk and out of my life when he grabbed hold of my shoulders and began to cry. "They just shot him," he sobbed. "They shot Jimmy Horn, man. He's dead," the boy told me. That was how I'd found out about Horn. Zap! Someone somewhere on the hospital ward was playing an out-of-tune piano. "A house is not a home," was the song. I was still fairly shell-shocked from the interview. The high yellow corridor lights were turned down low. It made it difficult for me not to peek into the brighter bedrooms we were passing. Two middle-aged men who appeared to be twins were playing chess in one room. A boy in his underwear was sitting in bed reading a mathematics text in another. A young boy in horn rims was reading Shockproof Sydney Skate by Mary Jane Meeker. I looked down at Asher, the beard. There was something about the scraggly face growth that appealed to me. "I've been thinking about a beard," I broke our mutual silence. "I don't understand my motivation, though."
"You want people to know how smart you really are," the aide grinned. "Beard's a pain-in-the-ass way to do it, though. Always getting spaghetti and cake, am I?" "I don't want people to think I'm smart." I watched the dull ceiling lights pass over my head. "I don't know exactly what it is. Not that, though."
We stopped at the patient's kitchen, and he went on about the physical hardships of a beard. It was the kind of conversation people have at wakes down south. You talk about anything but the wake and the wakee. Asher poured out some of the blackest coffee I'd ever seen. He had kind of an intriguing job, I was thinking.
I was also watching a pimply teenager who was in the kitchen with us. The boy was shoveling tablespoons of sugar into a tall glass of milk. He had fuzzy electric hair and looked burned out at 16. A fairly good pragmatic idea occurred to me in the kitchen. I began building up the nerve to ask Asher for an important favor.
"How much do you know about all this?" I asked for starters.
"The whole." Asher sipped the black coffee. "Just about, anyway. Shulman took me to dinner tonight. He told me the hospital position. He said I'd be the only one to supervise visits between you and Ben." I put cream and raw sugar in my coffee. All motions. I wasn't going to drink the muddy gedunk. It reminded me of the Mississippi River.
"So you're pretty tight with Shulman?"
"We agree. We disagree. He generalizes too much for my taste. Textbooks, sometimes. Basically, he trusts my instincts, though. Believe it or not, I was in Columbia before this."
"He told you about Jimmy Horn?" I said.
"Yes, he told me. But I still wasn't prepared for what I heard back there with Toy. Most of us hadn't taken him all that seriously before." I decided to ask Asher for a big favor. I was close to blurting it out anyway.
I started by moronically sipping some coffee. "I don't want to play on your emotions," I said, "but I knew Horn for about 8 years before this happened. In a lot of ways, we were friends."
"In some ways," I corrected myself. "That doesn't have anything to do with you, except that it gives you an idea of what's going on in my head right now. My mind is a fucking wreck." The aide nodded. Once again, the coffee.
"Okay," I sighed. "The problem, I'd like to read what's been written about Toy since he's been in here. I could ask Alan Shulman, but I'm afraid to. If Shulman turns me down, I'm fucked. I'm looking for names, dates, anything about Thomas Berryman."
"I swear to you that I won't use anything that would hurt anybody else in here. On Bowditch." Asher nodded again. He really looked exhausted, and I felt sorry for him. His eyes shifted out the kitchen window into the dark exercise yard. Beyond the floodlights on the wall was a staff parking lot, then the end of the hospital grounds, then the ocean. At night you could only see the wall, though. Salvador Dali couldn't have done it better. When you turn left outside the front door, the inside door, Asher turned to me, there's a small conference room. Wait in there. I'll try to get you what you need. The aide brought me Ben Toy's admission notes, workup notes, daily nursing charts, over 200 pages in all. Everything was stamped, confidential or not to be removed from this room. Some of it was typed, but most of the notes were handwritten in black ink. I started to copy names, addresses, telephone numbers. Jimmy Horn was mentioned several times in the daily notes. Harley Wynn was mentioned. Thomas Berryman didn't come up that frequently. I recognized none of the other names or addresses. There was nothing to immediately connect anyone in Tennessee. I found Toy's admission note especially interesting, though. Mr. Toy is an extremely handsome, well-developed young man from the northwestern part of Texas. He has a history of not having close, stable relationships, with the exception of one long-standing boyhood relationship. Mr. Toy claims to have killed a man and a woman, and some traumatic incident has precipitated a severe depression with accompanying physical hostility. He punches walls and people. Mr. Toy has also had auditory hallucinations. Immediate care inside a psychiatric hospital is recommended, and suicidal behavior should not be discounted with this young man. I stopped reading as I remembered one fact that put a damper on my excitement and speculation about Toy and Thomas Berryman. Jimmy Horn had been shot down by Bert Poole. I'd seen it several times on film. It was as clear in my mind as the famous televised sequence in which Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald.